Have you ever been hypnotized, Beth?
I haven't, no, not at all.
I haven't either, and I'm absolutely intrigued about the whole thing, particularly because I can't see, and I'm wondering if blind people can be hypnotized. And it is our lucky day because we have a hypnotist on the show. This is Inside Ouch. I'm Emma Tracy. In London, there's Beth Rose.
Hi there.
And on the line from Colchester is disabled hypnotist Stuart Thompson. Hi, Stuart.
Hello. I like that.
How are you doing?
Hypnotist. It's quite a title. I like it.
Let's get the important question out of the way first. Can blind people be hypnotised?
Yes. It's never crossed my mind. I'm sure I've probably hypnotised blind people in the past. I've obviously not used a dangling stopwatch technique that you see on TV because that probably wouldn't work. But apart from that, I think it would be all right.
Now, you got in touch with us, or your lovely wife did, actually. You sent us this great kind of tabloidy headline. I've broken every bone in my body, and now I help people with chronic pain through hypnosis. Explain that to me. Are you a stuntman as well, or?
No, I've got osteogenesis imperfecta, or brittle bone disease, so I like to estimate I've probably broken every bone in my body, but there might be the odd toe I've missed out. And one of the things that got me into this profession was that I had broken every bone in my body at some point, and that left me with a certain amount of pain. And I don't necessarily mean acute pain, but chronic pain, things that hurt continuously. And that's how I got into hypnotherapy. I was speaking to a hypnotist in the briefest conversation who said to me, "Did you know I get people over chronic pain?" And that was nearly 16 years ago, and that was where the journey began, really.
How do you do it? What's the sort of technique?
There's a couple of different ways, really, that I pull together. The first is, and the simplest, is teaching someone to take their attention away from the pain, to be aware of it, but then to not give it headspace. And I know a lot of people use mindfulness in a similar way, that they acknowledge that the pain is there, but then they train their brain not to focus on it. And that does oversimplify it in some ways, but that's the first thing that we would do, in the same way that, you know, you can live next to a clock. My parents live in a town, and we've got a really loud clock that chimes every 15 minutes in the town centre. When I first go and visit them, I think, how can they live there with this clock? But after a few hours of being there, I stop noticing the clock. And I guess chronic pain's like that, in that we try and train you to know that the pain's there, but your brain doesn't need to keep drawing your attention to it. And I think that once we can teach someone those techniques, it empowers them. But also, when I'm working with someone with chronic pain, I'm talking to them about the other things that go with it, because it's highly likely that if you're in a lot of pain, it's going to have affected other areas of your life as well. You're going to be maybe feeling more isolated. You're certainly going to be more anxious, because you're going to be spending a lot of time thinking about what's tomorrow's pain going to be like, or what's the pain going to be like when I try and do this particular thing I enjoy doing. And also, there can be a real knock-on effect to people's self-esteem as well, because they can feel isolated, or they can start to question, is this the way it's going to be forever? And I think when I work with someone, I look at the whole picture of what's going on for them with the pain, and try and get them to, for them to be in control of it, rather than feeling like it can only be controlled by drugs or some dreadful pain group that they attend.
What is a pain group, and what makes it dreadful?
Well, I can't speak for all pain groups, but I've got a lot of clients and friends who've been in chronic pain, who've told me that the first part of call from the hospital was to visit a pain group, where people, from what I gather, are told that, you know, they're not actually in pain, and basically they're just not accessing life enough, and if they lived life to the full, they wouldn't be in pain. And there's a kind of patronising element, I think, that goes on, where people imagine that if you're in chronic pain, then you've already given up on life and you're isolated. In fact, I know lots of people that lead really vibrant, exciting lives and just happen to be in a heck of a lot of pain. And I think sending them to a pain group is completely wrong.
I suppose we got to say that pain is different for everybody, and everybody has different ways of managing it. And we've, you know, spoken to plenty of people over the years who wouldn't be able to function at all without pain meds, and who use them,
totally,
you know, to their advantage.
And my message is not at all that everyone should sort of ditch their painkillers and throw them away. But I think what I've come to realise working with people is that so many people are taking all those painkillers and are still in a tremendous amount of pain.
How does hypnotism work? Because everyone does think of the, you know, the dangling watch.
There's lots of different ways that we would hypnotize someone. So there's some techniques that we call eyes open hypnosis, which is just about talking and using language patterns to change the way you feel. You know, we can make you think of things quite easily. If I said to you, don't think of a pink elephant, then I'm hoping you're probably thinking of a pink elephant.
Yeah.
And that, you know, in a way, that's me influencing your thoughts in quite a simplified way. But the traditional type of hypnosis that people think of or expect is me talking them down into a very relaxed state. And then when they're in that state, they become what we might call suggestible or influenceable.
So is it still the case that you go into a trance, or is it more of a coping strategy?
It depends, really. With a lot of the work that I do, I try and influence people to learn self-hypnosis, which is about taking themselves down into a very deep state where they can influence their own thoughts. And in many ways, it's very similar to a meditative state. And I wouldn't like to get into an argument with someone that taught meditation about what the difference was, because I think they're probably very similar. So it's about that state where we are more mindful and aware of our thoughts.
It's kind of similar to mindfulness then, because the mindfulness is the biggie at the moment. I mean, people they're talking about mindfulness all the time. They're not talking about hypnosis as much.
Yeah, I think it really fascinates me that the whole mindfulness thing, because it really is so similar to hypnosis. I guess the problem with hypnosis is people imagine that there's this sort of Svengali figure standing over them, telling them what to think and what to feel. And there is a bit of that. But for a lot of the work I do, it's about getting people to understand the way they think. I talk to people a lot about how we don't have to feel a particular feeling or a particular thought. We can change our emotions quite easily. And that's definitely very similar to mindfulness. And I do work and workshops with people on mindfulness because they're so similar. But yeah, mindfulness has certainly become the buzzword.
Just going back to the hypnosis, could you potentially make somebody cluck like a chicken?
No, and I think when I trained, that was probably the most disappointing thing, because I do remember keep asking my tutor, when are we having that lesson where we make people cluck, and it never came. No, we can't make you do. We use the expression hypnotic suggestion, because we're suggesting to your brain what it should think and feel, but we certainly can't command or control you, because ultimately you've got your own values and your own way of thinking. So if you came to see a hypnotherapist who was going to, I don't know, something traditional like stop you smoking or lose weight, then they're not going to be able to make you cluck like a chicken unless you really wanted to. And then, you know, I'm sure we'd oblige, but so no, we couldn't do it against your will.
Does this mean all those TV programmes where they drag out a supposed audience member and make them cluck like a chicken or run around like a dog, was that all just kind of fake then?
Well, I wouldn't like to say it was fake, but I would possibly suggest that some people like to be on TV, don't they? You know, I think that's possibly where I would probably go with those people. Or, you know, there's also something, isn't there, for some people about placebo and them wanting to believe in something. And I think for many years, hypnosis was kind of something magical, so people wanted to believe they were doing that. But yeah, there's certainly no magic when people see me.
When you first heard about hypnosis and hypnotherapy, did you automatically think, oh yeah, that would definitely work, or were you a bit skeptical and you found through practice that it has helped?
I'm a massive skeptic about everything. People often imagine when you tell them that you're a complementary therapist that you're going to be into crystals and the whole new age world, and I'm certainly not. I'm a real skeptic. So when I was told about hypnotherapy, I was really dismissive of it at first, and then I started doing a lot of reading, and I looked at people who'd had teeth removed under hypnosis, or women that are able to give birth using hypnobirthing and those kind of things. And that really fascinated me, because I've started to think, well, there is something in there. And I know when I've been in acute pain, you sometimes can be in so much pain that your brain moves away from it, and you end up feeling like you're somewhere else. You end up, you know, your brain almost overrides it itself. And I think that's what fascinated me. That's what set the journey off. But yeah, I was very skeptical at first. I thought perhaps it was going to be another potion or magic.
Yeah. You remember events in your life around the fractures you've had and the pain that's gone along with them. Tell me a bit more about that.
I think I do, and I think lots of people with a similar sort of impairment to mine would have a similar story. So if you were to talk to me about, I think the obvious one for me is my wedding day, which of course is a fantastic day. But I do remember in the build-up to it, my biggest thought was, you know, how bad is the broken rib I've got at the moment going to be? And will I be that happy sitting up all day in a wheelchair? So that's a memory. Or I think about my daughter being born. I remember that I had a really bad back injury at the time. And I was sort of the whole time planning, oh gosh, how's that going to feel? And of course, it doesn't take away from the thing, but it certainly punctuates it. And I can, you know, back to childhood, I can remember the birthday parties that I went to with various pots and plastic casts on my arms and legs.
I have to ask, did your wife do hypnobirthing? Did you bring her through it in that way?
No, but my wife, how can I put this? My wife actually, bizarrely, gave birth to our last child with very little pain relief, because she has a really fantastic, her own methods of controlling that pain. So I guess it did influence her. But I don't think my wife would trust me enough for me to be her therapist. Proximity is not always the best approach.
Stuart Thompson, thank you so much for joining us. He's Stuart Hypnotist in general online. This has been Inside Out. I've been Emma Tracy.
And I've been Beth Rose.
And you can get in touch with us during the week by emailing ouch@bbc.co.uk, on Twitter @bbcouch, like us on Facebook, or visit the website bbc.co.uk/news/disability. Bye-bye.
Bye.